CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello, and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor at City AM. And it's another busy week in the offing. I'll be joined in a bit by Poppy Wood, City AM's reporter on all things coronavirus related, to look at the government's roadmap for getting us out of lockdown. And then James Ashton, the former City editor and executive editor at The Standard, and before that City editor at The Sunday Times, will check in to discuss his new book, The Nine Types of Leader. We'll also have a look at the business landscape today and what, in particular, it means for the capital we all know and love. But first, I'll offer a very quick recap of the week that was. In a busy tumble of full-year results, it seemed the dividend was back with a bang, at least in mining. Glencore, BHP and Rio Tinto will all deliver the goods after a set of strong results. And the banks too were starting to dish out the cash a bit. Barclays reported stronger results than many investors were expecting, and NatWest felt sufficiently confident to put 300-odd million quid up themselves, despite a similar-sized loss. Most of that, of course, will still go to the Treasury. Speaking of, borrowing figures in the UK continued to concern, although record low interest rates mean we shouldn't panic just yet. Despite the last-minute self-assessment scramble, HM Treasury recorded its largest ever January deficit, or at least the largest since records began, and the first for a decade. Keir Starmer, Labour's leader, attempts to concoct his own way of filling the holes in the government coffers with the British Recovery Bond, something which would allegedly allow an ordinary Brit to put money into a fund with an interest rate that will also apparently revolutionise our economy. Rates would, we're told, be competitive or even higher than the market would offer, which raises the question of why the party would voluntarily add to its borrowing costs. But honestly, all eyes this week are on the vaccine rollout and Boris Johnson's roadmap for reopening Britain, with all the economic benefits that will no doubt bring. Here to discuss just that is Poppy Wood, our COVID-19 reporter at City AM. Poppy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We have been, I say we, everybody in the UK has been looking forward to this week for some time now, since the PM announced that the roadmap for getting back to some form of normality will come out this week based on all sorts of data and vaccine rollout, which is now at 17 million adults. But as ever with this government's communication strategy, shall we say, a decent amount of it is kind of known already. And chief amongst them is the school return day, I suppose.
Yeah, so really the only firm date that Boris Johnson and the rest of the cabinet have committed to is the 8th of March for reopening schools. There was slight flip-flopping a couple of weeks ago saying that it might happen a little bit later, but that was met with lots of frustration from schools and parents. So they are sticking to that 8th of March date at the moment. But everything else is really quite hazy. So the government has promised that they will give schools 2 weeks' notice to reopen, which means that if any umming and ahhing happens on Monday, schools will reopen later. But it's likely that Johnson will, you know, appease most parents in the country who've had their kids at home for months now, and reopen them on that date and leave everything sort of up in the air and to assess basically the effect of reopening schools, the effect of children going back to school on transmission rates before committing to any firm date for any other lifting of lockdown restrictions for the moment. So really, there's not too much certainty that we can bank on. We will get on Monday a roadmap of, you know, a rough timeline of reopening things. But things like pubs, restaurants, I expect we won't be knowing whether those will reopen for quite some time at the moment.
It really is about that data from schools reopening, which is what many scientists say kind of kicked off the third spike, if you will, of the COVID-19 cases back in November, December. That level of uncertainty means we will also probably get an announcement this week about the financial package to go along with, you know, lengthening restrictions beyond March the 8th for pubs, restaurants, as well as other businesses on the high street. Lots of speculation at the back end of last week that Rishi Sunak would announce an extension to the furlough scheme, maybe in its full form, or maybe in a slightly varied, flexible furlough style system to ensure that those jobs don't disappear in May, as well as business rate relief. You know, Poppy, you have been looking at all these practices for a very long time, and the numbers are eye-watering, even if you sometimes sort of lose track of them. But all of this costs money, but Rishi Sunak doesn't really have a choice, does he?
No, I mean, the amount of businesses that have been sort of kept in hibernation for almost a year now is quite something, but to drop them off at this stage would be a huge mistake. And I think he's aware that it's going to be a huge compromise, and obviously we're going to have to, you know, pay the cost for this later. But there are so many businesses that just can't reopen under the current conditions that he will have to extend things like the furlough scheme and business rates relief at the moment. There's increasing frustration, especially in the hospitality industry, which has really, you know, borne the brunt of this pandemic. We haven't seen things like pubs and restaurants opened in their full capacity for, you know, a few seasons now. And some sectors are warning that they are really still facing falling off, you know, the edge of a cliff. The Nighttime Industry Association, which represents nightclubs and theatres and all manner of, you know, evening nighttime entertainment in the UK, has warned that 80% of nightclubs face going bust within 2 weeks, the end of, you know, February. So there are businesses really facing the edge here, and it feels like, you know, the Chancellor really doesn't have a choice. It's not quite the March budget that I think he was looking forward to maybe providing some relief in, and it looks like it's just going to be ticking current schemes over the edge for quite some time to provide a lifeline for those businesses that really are still in the thick of the worst parts of the pandemic.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And once you start those schemes, you kind of have to follow them through to the end. Just one more question, because obviously we've got, you know, every day on the airwaves, we have Save Scientists, and we know that scientists inside government are all pushing for a very, very cautious reopening. And indeed, there is some polling that says similarly that the public would like that. But as a very influential group of Tory backbenchers growing in number who are tiring of the pandemic, and that will change the politics of Boris's decisions, not necessarily with this roadmap and with schools reopening, but in sort of mid-March, if cases are still low, if the vaccine rollout's still going well, there's going to be some very loud voices on those backbenches pushing Boris, who, you know, has a 80-seat majority, so it's not a massive issue, but isn't in the most secure position of an 80-seat majority PM. He's going to have to listen to those voices as well, right?
Yeah, so the COVID Recovery Group, which has voiced itself as a sort of anti-lockdown, perhaps, maybe not that fervently, but definitely raised suspicions over the extent and scope of our current lockdown measures throughout the pandemic. Last week, a group of 60 MPs in that COVID Recovery Group wrote to the Prime Minister urging him to, you know, really be clear about this lifting of lockdown and trying to get us back on our feet as soon as possible. And that really has ramped up pressure within the government on setting out a clear timeline, because at this point it's looking like we're not going to have a clear timeline for quite some time. Puts Boris Johnson in quite a tricky position, because obviously he's going to want to appease his own party, but also he has promised that, you know, he's promised that this should be the last lockdown, but he hasn't quite committed to that. So it's a very tricky balance to strike between giving people some hope on the horizon, giving backbenchers and his own party some hope on the horizon. At the moment, yeah, it's not quite sure whether we will get any firm dates on Monday, and that's likely to increase pressure in his own government even more. People are going to be wanting some firm dates on that.
For sure, for sure. It's going to be an interesting few weeks, albeit with us still stuck from home predominantly, it seems, but at least the weather's getting warmer. Poppy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now to today's guest, James Ashton, something of a living legend of business journalism. He's held posts at the Sunday Times and the Mail, but most of you will know him from his role as city editor and executive editor at the Evening Standard, and many of you will no doubt remember him. He's the author of a new book, The Nine Types of Leader, which builds on his years of experience of CEOs up close to give us an insight into what makes bosses tick and how those in boss class managed to get there. It's a genuinely great read. He's also got a podcast and writes regularly, including for City AM, on business, leadership, tech and investment. James, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be on, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, yeah. We're going to talk first really about the book, The Nine Types of Leader, and then we'll kind of talk what it tells us about today's business landscape, as well as just with your old business journalist hat on and, you know, obviously your time at the Standard and my time at City AM, people who care a lot about London, the city, and ensuring that the capital remains as competitive as it can be. But first, the book, you know, as you say in the introduction, there are academic reads on leadership, and indeed Harvard and Stanford MBAs have made an awful lot of money out of telling people how to manage and how to lead. But you wanted to do something slightly different with the book.
Yeah, Andy, it's fair to say there's a lot of it about leadership and books and so on. And I was really thinking all the way along this, what have I got to add? What can I say that's different? And I didn't want to write that academic text. There are a lot of people who can do that analysis of the data and the TSRs that these leaders have delivered and their styles and so on. I wanted to write something largely through the prism of the interview, the CEO interview that I've done a lot of over the years. So it's a very journalistic take on what I've made of leaders over the last 20 years. A lot of these ideas filtered through 350 plus interviews, the sit-down interviews, but also others I've added on and other observations in that time. I remember an old editor of mine told me years ago, write what you know. And so when it came to thinking about the sort of book I wanted to do and what I wanted to be known for, if you like, then it felt like the CEO was a currency I'd accrued over the years, and that was my starting point.
And that makes perfect sense, and it makes sense when you read through it as well, because you have obviously grouped CEOs that you've spoken to and have personal experience of into these nine fields. I want to tuck into two areas particularly, one of which is the first chapter about the alphas, which is your sort of archetypal corporate leader that maybe is not as popular in the boardroom as it once was, the sort of decision maker, you know, the personality, etc. But, you know, you've noticed in the book, and certainly anyone looking at any kind of congressional hearing recently in particular will have noticed, that the alpha seems to sort of be back in the tech world. But I mean, do you want to kind of define how you view those alphas through the book? Because it's not universally negative by any sense, but they do seem to have the seeds of their own kind of failure in their very personality sometimes.
I think so, in some cases. I mean, yes, you're right. Alphas is the first chapter, and I rationalise that alphas and the alphas that I've known always insist on coming first. So that's where it was in the book. And I think alpha used to be something to aspire to. I mean, the investors are always seeking alpha and still are. But I think alpha as a boardroom character has become quite a pejorative term, because it signifies that you'll do things your own way, you won't necessarily listen to those around you, it's banging fists on the table and so on. And I think there's the way global finance and investment has gone, a lot of these types have been streamlined out of the boardroom. I think in the way that investors have demanded focus over the years, we don't have the old conglomerates anymore on the stock market that we used to. If you look back to someone like Lord Hanson, I think at one point his empire included building materials, cigarettes and frozen chickens, all purely because he thought this was a good idea and he pulled this together. And he did make a lot of money for a lot of people, including himself. But I think the way that shareholders have looked for focus, they want a company to do one thing really well, it means that those sorts of alphas have been pushed out. And clearly we will probably not see the likes of Sir Philip Green again. And the point I make in the chapter, as you say, is that these alpha types, these super powerful business leaders, have been rebooted for the 21st century. You do see them all over Silicon Valley, and because they're delivering fantastic growth, this is the likes of Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos and so on. I mean, you know, Wall Street are supplicants, because all shareholders look for growth. So I think if you can keep delivering And you are a sufficiently big personality. I mean, if you, you know, up until the announcement the other week, were you buying Amazon shares because of Amazon, or were you buying them because of Jeff Bezos's vision? Well, arguably the two are intertwined. So I think those alphas really, it's not really fair to say they can get away with murder, but they can lead how they choose to lead because they keep delivering. Now, are the seeds sown? I think there is. Possibly times not too long from here when these big tech companies might need a different type of leader. We've seen the beginning of the skirmishes, if you like, Facebook versus Australia. Are these companies platforms, or are they publishers? Should they operate and pay in the way that a lot of other companies have to do? There's also what happens on Capitol Hill as the regulators look more closely at Google and Facebook and others. So is that alpha founder, the very, very bold, brave, risk taker, Zuckerberg type, really the sort of leader they need going forward from here? You can argue not, but then because you have these many class of share structure, you have ultimate power with some of these leaders that you never saw with the old alphas of Hansen's time.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating kind of read through and read across from Hansen's time to now and looking a little bit into the future. And I know also in the chapter about founders where there's some, an element of crossover, which features that amazing interview with Richard Branson kind of following him around Detroit, which was a great little read, great anecdote, and great kind of behind the scenes piece of what it's like on those big CEO days. You talk about giving up, and giving up power is obviously very difficult as well. But skipping right to the end of the book,
I think that's a real challenge for founders, and you see this so many times, Andy, that the best founders are very, very self aware, and they know when there is someone else, a professional manager, who could take on the enterprise that they started, that they have led since it was around the kitchen table.
Yeah, and which, by the way, is absolutely something that is not just an issue at CEO level in FTSE 100 firms, but right across, even medium-sized businesses or smaller. But thinking about you say in the intro that not everyone's going to be happy with where they end up grouped amongst the CEOs that Most would be quite happy to be in the humans chapter at the end, which is really about sort of consensual leadership and really quite modern, forward-focused leadership. But that is no guarantee necessarily of success, as we've seen recently, right?
I'm not sure if any of the types is a guarantee of success, and I've tried to look at the light and shade in all of them, because I think so much of good leadership comes down to circumstance, and that actually is another way of saying luck. But with the humans, what I try to do with that ninth chapter is they're a little bit like a magpie. That they are, I would describe them as the leadership type that we might see more of in the future, particularly post-pandemic. They've taken some of the best bits of campaigners and lovers and even alphas and sort of balled that up and taken that forward. So I think the humans are the ones that are most comfortable in what I would call the glass door era. They understand that the modern corporation is more porous than ever, and the conversations and this style of management, whether they're dealing with their own staff or suppliers or the media, I think it's all the same. It's all in the same melting pot. I think these leaders are they've got high emotional intelligence. I think they're very good at listening, and they're very good at admitting when they've got something wrong. I think they're very they see loyalty as a real key attribute for them to engender among the workforce, particularly when that workforce is working remotely and no one's trooping into the same office block anymore.
Yeah, I mean, COVID-19 is going to accelerate a lot of these leadership challenges, I suppose. As you say, it has become a different kind of leadership. I found it just at City AM, just it's so much different just in the way you communicate with people via Zoom and trying to keep people together as part of the team. And I think we've been lucky enough to do that. The reporters have been really on board with it, really excited, but it does create new challenges, and it certainly is one that's going to probably change the way leadership works going forward anyway. We've all sort of been through this almost traumatic year of changes, and that's going to have a massive impact. But bringing it sort of right up to the present day and thinking, with your experience of leadership and, of course, of years of business journalism. Right now, we've got our own political leaders fulminating over what to do about rebuilding the economy, keeping business going, etc., etc. We're just starting to hear bits and pieces out of the Chancellor that business rates and furlough will potentially be extended for a little bit longer as lockdown restrictions continue, which I guess makes sense. But as part of the wider picture, which is so important for a leader as a vision, the government seems to be running after levelling up, as they phrase it, which is a fairly sort of amorphous term. But with your Evening Standard head, I grew up in London, obviously City AM here, you know, London is a massive, important part of the economy. It is still the driver of the economy. Do you think that they've got the balance right in ensuring that, you know, a focus on infrastructure spend and building up business in the rest of the country, important though that is, I think they've got the right balance right in ensuring that the capital remains, you know, the golden goose?
Well, I think, look, I've lived and worked in and around London for most of my career, and I think London should be worried where it is at the moment. I mean, I think levelling up is a good phrase, and I think it's something that, you know, should be encouraged. I was born in Yorkshire. I know the challenges of getting a train sideways across the country. It should not be as hard as that. And you know, we know from how TfL works in London, if you have that big agglomeration effect of a mobile workforce across, for example, the north of England, then it helps business, it helps jobs, it just helps, you know, it helps the glue of the region. So you absolutely need to level up and focus on those other parts of the UK. The concern is that London is seen as you say, a golden goose. It can look after itself, and there is this concern, you know, about leveling down. I don't think it's a zero sum game. The Chancellor is at. We mustn't forget this is still a fairly new government that won a very big majority. So obviously the last year has been unprecedented, but unless something goes horribly wrong, we're still in the foothills, if you like, of probably a 10-year Tory government. So it's times like the budget that we need we need two things. Obviously, we need those emergency measures now to show how we can get people back to work and get this semblance of normality, but also that long-term vision, how we look at things like the tax code, business rates, planning laws, and how we deploy state aid, which we can do now. Specifically with London, this is now a city in decline, in population terms at least, and that can't be forgotten, that you need to keep investing in London. It is the economic powerhouse of the UK, and I think, you know, business leaders understand that, and I think Treasury must understand that, because that's where a lot of the income comes from. So I think business is very good at using other parts of the UK, and actually that connectivity between London and other parts is really good. For example, PricewaterhouseCoopers put in several hundred jobs in Bradford quite recently, and it's all about hub and spoke and these different regions working together. But I think, yeah, the investment in London is really important. For example, you need certainty about TfL, that sustainable plan, the you know, hugely important asset that means that London, the working city, can go about its business every day.
Yeah, and part of the, you know, business leaders being able to make that case publicly as well, you know, again, comes back to leadership and their ability to hold people's attention and take people with them, I guess. The business leaders, you know, you were covering it right up close, you know, post the financial crash of 2008-2009, you know, business reputation was in the tank, and there are some who are saying that, you know, people like Mike Ashley and Philip Green or whatever obviously don't help because they end up in the headlines. But with the way that banks have stepped up in the kind of the COVID crisis, in the way that businesses have pivoted to play their part in various procurement, and, you know, even down to distilleries turning into hand sanitizers, is the inbox, the daily inbox filler that I was getting back in March and April. You know, do business leaders have a chance to make that case again that business is good for Britain, that the entrepreneurialism, that the act of wealth creation is a good thing, because there are people in the city who still won't say it publicly, but they feel like the apology period post the global financial crisis has or at least needs to come to an end.
I think it must have done, really. I think for me the pandemic underscored that social contract, which is what connects business with the people that they employ, their suppliers, and the broader communities. And you can never forget that, given all the state money that's gone into those businesses to help them tick over during this last year. And I think the best leaders in that time have been the ones that recognise they have a duty of care to their staff. They're not worried about them sitting at home, having a half day and going out to play football or whatever. They're the ones that are worried about their mental health and so on. I think there's so many examples of business that have done good things over the last year. The extra pay they might have given people, the support into the community. But I think there's still, it's sometimes the bad behaviour that gets the headlines and is remembered. I think now, coming out of the crisis, it's very important for business to think about their actions. And there's the choreography of, you probably should pay back your government support before you arrange the next dividend and so on. And I think, because I don't think that social contract goes away. And this is why a company like BASF, the German chemicals company, got a lot of headlines. It took the soft loan from government and then it decided to close the plant. Well, that is business behaviour that's not acceptable. And it's a shame, because I think the vast majority of businesses have acquitted themselves really well. Of course, Andy, we forget we've gone through this Brexit time as well. And so much has been managed. You look at how the supermarkets, for example, Tesco, have acquitted themselves. Not only have they made sure that there's been no disruption in supply, but they've managed to give their staff extra money and massively scale up online delivery. But I think it's just the balance of where the headlines will go. And I just go back to London again. I think there's always been this issue, I think, with business leaders willing to speak out. And, I've known this from talking to them publicly and privately. And it was an issue around Brexit. I think it was an issue around financial crisis, and probably will be an issue post-COVID. And I think now, particularly with London in mind, this is the time to stand up and say, what is needed, what is wanted to keep London working and to bring it back. London has shrunk before. We shouldn't forget that. It's not a one-way street. And I think it's very important to weigh London against Leeds and Liverpool and Manchester. But because it is our only world city, we've got to think about what London needs versus New York, versus Paris and so on. This is wonderful. Look at the Hudson Yards development in New York. Look at the Grand Paris urban plan. I think it is absolutely crucial that you have the infrastructure, whether it's the tube working, whether it's Crossrail, finally. But it's also giving companies a reason to be here, this reason to invest in London. And that extends to things like the soft infrastructure, as I call it. Where's the next great theatre? Where's the next great bar? Because as we know, and because they're all your readers, businesses are all made up of people.
Yeah, and that is one of the things I think is most relevant when people talk about, London post-Brexit, London post-COVID, etc., etc. Making it, ensuring it remains the best place to live for people who want to go to those bars, to those theatres, to those restaurants, versus, as you say, New York, Singapore, etc. That's the real challenge that that you'd hope is appreciated at the very highest levels. Look, James, we could talk all day, but we probably shouldn't. But if people do want to hear more from you about leadership, how do they find your podcast?
The podcast, which is called Leading with James Ashton, is available on Apple or Spotify or leadingpod.com. And on that platform, it's beyond business. So it's business, charity, arts and sport leaders. And sometimes bringing two together, sometimes just one, and really getting them to share their thoughts on how they do it, how they got there, how they stay there, And the last one I did was Sir Mike Wigston from the RAF, which I was really pleased to get him, and it was fascinating. He actually said, look, he has been a fast jet pilot. He was patrolling the no-fly zones in Basra and so on, and very used to flying at extremely high speeds. But he said, I don't know why the RAF over 100 years has been choosing its leaders based on their hand-eye coordination as a 21-year-old. He thinks there should be, and he was one of those, he thinks there should be other ways of gaining credibility with the workforce, and he's probably right.
Yeah, he is. And I mean, the police force still does that to this day. Just, you know, people coming up from the bottom, there is probably an argument for more external expertise at the top. Brilliant, James. Wonderful chat. Thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Pleasure. And that's all from us now at The City View for this week in partnership with CMC Markets. Do join us next week when we might have a bit more intelligence on when we can go for a pint. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.